I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1973, the album Story and Songs from Robin Hood, the artist Walt Disney, Roger Miller, all kinds of people. My guest is Lauren Bouchard. Thank you so much for having me here.
Pleasure.
So, as we were talking about, I'm glad that you picked something that I'm familiar with, so I don't have to BS my way through it. But also, I want to start, number one, when did you realize animation was a thing? Like, I've never heard anybody talk about it. Like, you hear about people like, I remember the first time I made somebody laugh, and that's when I became a comedian at
right.
heart. What about animation?
I think like most kids, animation was always around. I think I was exposed to, I want to say in this order, Felix the Cat
mm-hmm.
and Popeye.
All right.
They were obviously... Came long before I was born, but mm-hmm. I think they were on reruns on a little Boston, local station.
Okay.
And it was one of the few stations that we got, aside from Channel 2, which was the PBS station.
Okay.
And my parents didn't want me to know there were other channels, by the way. I should add, I discovered that on my own and then proudly told them that I was like, did you know that if you change the dial, there's this thing called the $6 million man? They were very sweet. They were like, wow, look at that. But they had hid that from me so that they felt I could always just turn on the TV and I would only ever see Channel 2 in Boston, which was PBS. So I guess... I should also add, there's animation on Sesame Street and Electric Company, and
sure.
they used, they had great animation. They were
yeah.
sort of freewheeling. It was much more like going to an animation festival. I feel like
these
little shorts that were so odd.
I love those so much.
Yeah. They have it's nice to be exposed to Disney when you're a kid, but in a mm-hmm. way, it's great that back in the 70s when I was growing up, that there was this, also these hippie animators who were getting work with the Children's Television Workshop or whatever.
Adam Savage's dad was one of those, if I'm not mistaken. He did. I don't remember which ones he did. He might have done the guy who's in the orange juice glass. I love that one so much. I know it's stop motion, but I love that.
Yeah, they had weird stop motion, too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And yet, in a way, my relationship to a lot of Disney stuff, including the record we're going to talk about, was not as an animated piece. It was as audio only.
Interesting.
My parents were good parents and loved me, but myself and my sister, we did not get bedtime stories. We got bedtime records.
Really?
Yes. Or I should say... I think we got read to occasionally.
Sure.
But the real go-to was we slept in the same room when we were little and they would put on a record at bedtime. And it was a every night kind of thing. And I think we only had about 5 records.
It's amazing.
So for me, I loved animation, but really what I first loved was the audio from animation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's informed, I think, my entire career.
Of course.
And the reason I was excited to talk to you about Robin Hood was because out of all of them, Robin Hood was like the purest thing. I never saw the movie as a kid. There was no opportunity to see it. It came and went from theaters.
Okay, yeah.
It wasn't some kind of classic that got like revivalized and mm-hmm. Brought back out. It wasn't even released on VHS when VHS started up.
Right, probably.
Or if it was, I never saw it.
Yeah.
Finally, by the time I'm an adult, you could find it on DVD, and so I see it for the first time. Who gives a shit? I didn't care. at that point, and frankly. There are edits in the record that benefit the movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sequence in the movie that's kind of what I would think of as that's not like A-level Disney storytelling.
Sure,
it's a little weird. It's kind of a football game all of a sudden.
Yeah. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
It's like the soldiers and I don't know. The movie, in a way, for me, exists first and foremost as this thing that I listened to as a kid.
Yeah.
And looked at.
It's got the storybook on the inside.
Exactly.
I love this.
We had this, we had Jungle Book, we had Bambi.
Oh my God.
Peter Pan and not much else. Really,
wow.
I mean, we just circulated a very few records.
That's amazing.
So we listened to it a lot.
Yeah.
And so that's so I like your question, when did I realize animation was a thing? But the interesting thing was that I also, in a way, realized probably younger than most kids that audio was animation, maybe more than maybe the most important part of animation.
Yeah.
Sorry to say that. I just want to say to any animators out there, especially any that work with me, uh-huh. I love your work. Uh-huh. I'm a big fan. I love the way you did that thing with a guy and he looks like he's carrying a heavy thing and you're very talented. But for me, I always come to this stuff as radio first.
Yeah.
And try to get the casting right, to get the script right, get mm-hmm. the performance natural and interesting and musical sounding, then get the music right and mm-hmm. have the actual music musical sounding, and only once you've got all that working would I then start to think about picture. And we still approach everything that I work on, I approach that way still.
I found an old interview with you about Dr. Katz, if I'm not mistaken, because you were an audio editor. Were you an audio editor first or producer first?
Audio editor first.
So you specifically, again, I was going to ask you about radio because you did say, like, this is like radio. This is what this is for me.
Yeah.
And that just made me so happy because, like, I'm like a person who, like, I do my own comedy album, so I love to cut audio effects, but also dialogue.
Yeah.
And as I read that, I'm like, well, shit, now I need to listen to this album in a different way. And then I realized also, about as far as Robin Hood goes, in terms of like how it looks is really rough, and I like that.
Yes.
But the way it sounds is probably one of the more naturalistic in terms of Disney.
Yes.
And that makes perfect sense now.
Right.
You know?
Like, I got lucky.
Yeah.
And got their, like, got, this was their, like, their weird, like, this Let It Run album, like, or a movie. Let It Go.
Just, 100%.
So I'm looking at their album here. Peter Ustinov is Prince John. I think they're very
so
proud
good.
of their cast.
Uh-huh.
And yet, in a way, it's like, it's kind of this wonderful mishmash of this mm-hmm. British, you know, world. But then also they brought along their Phil Harris, who's, you know, uh-huh. always going to sound kind of country in America.
Sure.
And then they added this narrator and this country music,
mm-hmm.
sort of folk-y, Americana-y thing.
Uh-huh.
And they nailed it, as far as I'm concerned.
For
it
sure.
was a great, weird instinct to do that. I feel like they just let them go.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't, I don't feel like they did a lot of, you know, cutting or
right.
second takes. And these guys were probably in the room together. I'm reading the thing again. Terry Thomas as Sir Hiss.
Oh, I love him so much.
And so I'm picturing these two British kind of like giants, right? These two
mm-hmm.
British actors in the room just like, stop hissing in my, you know, like sort of like tutting each other and kind of like interrupting each other.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we're wrong. Maybe they create an incredible performance, but they weren't in the same room. But I feel like they were.
I doubt it. At the time, I don't know. Did they have that? I mean, they had the capability if you had somebody else acting with them, but come on, it's so back and forth and back and forth. It sounds too perfect.
It sounds that way to me. And it's just also just a relaxed delivery of a lot of these
mm-hmm.
lines. You sort of, in a way, the Robin Hood character, he's like barely doing anything. He's
mm-hmm.
kind of like, he's got this kind of like casual delivery. He's
yeah.
not at all like a Disney character, like,
wah, wah, wah. Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's not like a wisecracker
uh-huh.
or like even big. He's just
yeah.
kind of, oh, come on, old man. You know, he's got
mm-hmm.
this like very relaxed thing. And he's, I think, I don't know much about him. I'm going to look down at my credits again. Brian Bedford.
Yes.
I've heard he is like this British stage giant.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, probably, you know, this is what I've heard,
mm-hmm.
not interested in hearing someone come up to him and tell him how much they loved Robin Hood.
I would imagine.
Doesn't want to hear it.
Uh-huh.
If he were still alive, I would say, don't go talk to him about Robin Hood.
Oh, right.
He didn't. The material, whatever. For some reason, this is not what he wanted to be remembered for.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, here we are.
Yeah.
In my house, his performance was perfect.
Yeah.
And the way he and Little John are together, and it's just lovely. And
yeah.
So I love what they were doing. And yeah, not to be sort of grandiose, but I think it shaped my entire career.
Yeah, that's so good. I love that so much. Is there... This is always the hard part, and I try and ask it the right way every time and fail. But, you know, because you're always like, well, what were your influences? But, like, specifically, do you know, can you peg anything specific out of, like, listening to this album that reminds you of work you've done? Or an approach to the way you cut audio or write audio? Or, like, that's a, again, that's the question. Like, the look on your face is the look everybody gets when I ask that question. So it's like, I don't know.
Well, it's, I mean, that's good. I like, I guess the look on my face is, geez, I don't know. But, right. I mean, I like questions I don't know the answer to. I definitely, I think I'm finding it now. It's not like I'm 10 years old and I somehow synthesize everything I've listened to up till then and then dedicate my life to recreating it. I love people who are able to do that, and I'm jealous, and I, you know, but I, in my case, I think I got lucky. I fell into my job in animation and particularly editing audio. I fell into a situation where my boss, Tom Snyder, was fascinated with editing audio.
Okay.
And also these other things, fascinated with getting actors together, getting actors to improvise. So it wasn't like I brought Robin Hood to the work consciously. But as I think as I get older and start to look back, and you do have to ask the question, okay, yeah, I got lucky, but why was I able to take advantage of that luck?
Right.
Why am I even calling it lucky? Mm-hmm. If I hated working with actors, then it wouldn't be lucky. If I hated editing audio, then it wouldn't be lucky. So I call it lucky that I ran into Tom Snyder and that he hired me and that I got to do all those things. But what I'm really saying is also, in addition to being lucky, I was the right – something had prepared me to be the guy who could – leap into that moment,
yeah,
and would you know, seize it and know that it was like giving me pleasure. And so I think,
sure,
where Robin Hood prepped me to go back to your question, to do this work and the specific things, I think I would pick on a couple things. One is what we've already talked about, the sort of looseness and naturalism of the performances in this thing, and then I would also say the low-key music.
Mm-hmm.
They did an incredibly brave thing with that opening song.
Yeah.
They just let a guy play guitar and whistle.
And whistle. Yep. Yeah.
Where, I mean, they must have been in like a weird phase. Like, mm-hmm, Disney must have been like, well, who knows what works?
Uh-huh.
Or because, like, maybe, I don't know, something had bombed, or I don't know, Disney,
right,
had died. I don't know, like, what was going on at,
yeah,
those Disney studio. I know there's Disneyologists out there who can, I'm sure,
oh, yeah,
to mark exactly when the dark days were and, like, what the periods of, you know, terrible Lost in the Woods or whatever. And I know this must have been in that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, of course, since I love it, I have a different opinion.
Of course.
Whatever led them to let that opening theme be what it was,
mm-hmm,
I personally consider that brave, because it's not in your face. It's not reach out and grab you, big opening number type,
sure,
of energy. And, you know, most people who put in a big opening number do it for a very specific reason, which is you want to grab people's attention and hold it.
Sure.
You do not, even in the days when this was just in the theater, and granted, people are already, you know, there's inertia in a real movie theater, right?
Uh-huh.
People, it takes a lot for people to get up and leave.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'm a paranoid TV writer who, you know, is terrified of the, you know, somebody changing the channel.
Of course.
Maybe it's not as brave as I think, but I'll just say, in my opinion, they made a great creative decision, whether it was courageous or not, to let Roger Miller be him.
Yeah.
Do his thing,
uh-huh,
which is so laid back and full of air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, you literally hear his air.
So good.
And there's,
yeah,
just air around his, you know, you just this, he sounds like he's on his porch almost.
Yeah.
You hear like, dum,
dum, yeah, dum.
What was that?
I know.
I mean, that's like, did they know? Did they know, like, this, we're going to, like, that's like some Appalachian, like, sound record is getting, like, the authentic performance.
Right.
So they got this thing that I don't think had ever been in a Disney, that kind of,
no,
vibe hadn't been in a Disney movie.
Uh-uh.
They'd kind of, like, done some interesting, you know, left turns in, mm-hmm, terms of music. But that, to me, seemed like they just were letting a lot of the what I think of as a slightly slower pace, a little more air, and just a kind of a minimalism pervade the soundtrack.
Yeah.
And if you're just listening to the soundtrack, it's kind of lovely.
Yeah.
And if you're a kid and you're falling asleep, it's like more lovely
still.
Of
course, yeah.
And it really sets the tone. And obviously it picks up the pace a little bit. You know, even in the beginning, it has a little up-tempo moment, you know, when, and then I've since seen the movie and it's like a little chase sequence in the opening credits,
oh, yeah,
right?
Right, yep.
It's, it goes like double time.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, you pretty soon you're back into this kind of relaxed pace.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the work I'm doing now has a relaxed pace. I would say Bob's Burgers is paced up.
Sure.
But it kind of if you're into naturalism in terms of performances, in a way, you're always interested in slowness, in
yeah.
a way,
yeah.
or some version of slowness. Even if we're kind of moving things along quickly, and, mm-hmm. and Bob's moves at a quick pace, quick compared to, say, Dr. Cass, which
sure.
I'm proud to say was the slowest television show ever put on television. I believe, I think we have that, the fewest number of words ever spoken in a 22-minute show. But, I mean, in a way, it's an aesthetic that's it still really influences me because it's about ums and ahs
sure.
and hemming and hawing and just the little naturalistic things that we all do. Mm-hmm. You don't want all of them. You have, you know, naturalism doesn't mean being a slave to it,
mm-hmm.
But you're sort of, I guess, dropping them in here and there as a seasoning. And it's not like Disney, I don't know if Robin Hood has ums and ahs, but
right.
it has a certain just, you know, guy tapping his foot on the porch kind
sure.
of feel that runs through it.
Yeah, and, I mean, as opposed to like something else that might have come out around-ish the same time, like 101 Dalmatians is like constantly moving and there's a bunch of friggin' dogs everywhere. It's insane. The songs are quick. There's not a song on here that I would necessarily think anybody's going to submit for an Oscar, which is fine.
They should have.
Don't get me wrong. Maybe they did and I'm wrong. You know,
maybe,
I'll get
maybe
corrected.
They did and they just didn't get nominated, but they
sure.
should have gotten nominated.
Yeah. And there's something about the naturalism and the, as you said, the Americana stuff that isn't cynical.
No.
And there you could be doing Bob's Burgers naturalistic, but also do it in a cynical way where
right.
it's like, I'm using this as a thing.
Yes.
But it's like, no, that's just your preference.
Yeah.
And that's the way you'd like to tell a story. And I like that that actually comes across here, too.
I agree. Let's talk about the music. Because, I mean,
yeah.
I think the other, for me, like, you got the opening number and then you have the love song.
Yes.
Which is so beautiful,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
and kind of deep. You mm-hmm. know, there's this, like, almost darkness to it, you know, just a hint of it.
Yeah.
You know, life is brief, but when it's gone, love goes on and on. It's kind of like,
uh-huh.
like that sort of would be in like in church music or something
mm-hmm.
like where you're contemplating
mm-hmm.
the universe and your place in it. But it's surprising in a Disney song. And there's this sort of like also this confusing timeline in the lyric, you know, where she's like talking about them having been children together.
Yes.
And you know, that's part of the backstory of the characters, but it's also like as a standalone song, and especially if you're a kid and you sort of are listening to this with only half comprehending the story because,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're a kid, it's like almost like a parent singing to a child.
Okay.
You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, all grown up inside of me, right?
Sure,
she's
sure,
sort
sure.
of talking about watching somebody grow up. So you sort of, it becomes this like real weird like thing where this is a love song, but this is also almost like a mother to a child.
Yeah, okay. I get that.
I have kids now, and early on, like millions of people, we read that if you play soothing classical music to them, that they will get some kind of benefit from it, that it sort of, you know, helps them fall asleep and,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, helps you drop into the whatever. I was responsible for basically one song on our kids' mixtape that we put them to sleep to every night. So my wife, I mean, we agreed on this, but we just got lucky and we found this Baroque Adagio's 2-CD set
uh-huh.
that her stepfather had, and we just were like, well, let's rip that. It's great. It's like, that's perfect. And then we put the love theme from Robin
Hood
as the first song.
Uh-huh.
So my kids have heard that song every night of their lives.
Jesus.
And they are now 7 and 9. And even though they basically don't like it, we still put the Sleepy Time mix on every time they go to sleep. And in a way, at this point, I have kind of admitted, like, guys, it's for me. Like, just let me put it on.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to read to you, and I like to hear it, and you guys tolerate it. So I've heard it every night for 9 years.
Yeah.
They've heard it every night of their lives, and it's not getting old.
That's crazy.
It's Bach. It's Vivaldi.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the love theme from Robin Hood in our house. You know, it's these. This really standing the test of time. It's just one of those songs. I think it's kind of perfect. And like when, you know, I was real like kind of hormonal when they were first born. You know, you get sleep deprived, sure. And they say, can I just have a sideline here? Everyone talks about how the mom gets hormones that she didn't have before when the baby's born. No one warns the dad is also going to have completely changed brain chemistry.
Yeah.
And so I would like basically get weepy every time I listened to that song when my kids were babies. So it's really become important. And I stand by that song. And then you get Not in Nottingham, which is like, also a perfect song.
Yeah.
And it's so simple. And he's just this like sort of lilting little thing, and it's sad.
Yep.
And it's beautiful, and it's just like three chords, but it's just like this perfect melody.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen people have covered it, and I've clicked on a few of them. I'm interested, you know, I'll mm-hmm. check out like if Mumford and Sons have covered it or whatever.
Sure.
But like in a way that, I mean, that original version is perfect.
Yeah,
it's perfect.
His voice. I mean, it makes me want to cry thinking about it. Yeah. Like that's how good it is.
Yeah.
And I mean, in the movie, there's plenty of imagery to go along with it and tug at the heartstrings. But honestly, listening to it, and again, some of that's memory, but listening to it, it's like his voice is just so. I mean, soothing's one word. I don't know if there's a better word for what it is that it's just like guides you along, that just like you want to keep listening. And,
yeah.
And I'm not like a big. I don't hate country or anything, but I'm also not a big country fan. But I just love the shit out of this.
Yeah.
You know.
Same. It transcends genre in a way.
Sure.
It's just. Like a perfect song that happens to have a few of those like seventh chords and kind of little countryisms in it, but it doesn't feel self-conscious. Like you were saying earlier, it doesn't feel self-consciously country. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like these guys were like, get it?
Right.
Like we're making Robin Hood, but country. They didn't do that at all.
Mm-mm.
They have all these British actors,
yep.
And they just happened. It's almost like they just got the best guy for the job and turned him loose.
Yeah.
You know, is what it feels like,
mm-hmm.
And it's so lovely. And it's I think also raining in that scene. And again, mm-hmm. I'm mm-hmm. this is me coming at it as a kid. You just hear this like shh. I didn't even know it was rain when I was a kid. You know, you're just like, I don't know. It's I guess the record's static. But it adds to the thing
for sure.
And then it comes out. There's like an organ playing, and then it's. You hear this conversation between the church mice,
mm-hmm.
the Friar Tuck and the church mice. And Friar Tuck is that actor, Slim Pickens, right? Hold on.
Who is it?
Crap. Andy Devine. Forget
Andy
I said
Slim Thank
Pickens.
You. There we are. Yep.
Scratch that. And he does, and he's got that scratchy voice, and it's so appealing, and you've heard it before, but you don't know where.
Mm-hmm.
And that little tiny voice as the church mouse, who sounds to me like Winnie the Pooh or Piglet or one of them.
I think it is. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean,
I think it is Piglet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's you know, and it adds to the song, and you know, right at the end where you have this sweet little conversation. I guess that's the other thing we should talk about. Is sort of like. Sweetness between characters in a story as expressed in a performance, you know, that's I think everyone thinks they're putting it in their story,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't always make it in.
Sure.
I think there's a way in which writers sometimes skimp on that because it can get a little saccharine and nobody wants it to be too much. Or they put in a love story and it's supposed to be sweet, mm-hmm. but there's no chemistry. You don't actually believe it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, these cardboard characters that just like, you know, hero, heroine, they fall in love, but you don't ever know why.
Yeah.
Like, what is it about her that he likes? What is mm-hmm. it about him that she's attracted to? And so I feel like what's nice here is there is a little bit of that because it's so this close, you know, it's this close recording.
Yeah.
Because you have the sense of the intimacy of their voices, you kind of believe everybody likes everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, except the villains.
Of course.
But even they have this really intimate relationship, this, you know, this Sir Hiss and Prince John have this like kind of whispery, almost bedroom voice when they're talking to each other. So in a way, everybody's like in bed with everybody in this movie, mm-hmm. which is really nice. And they got these little kids who are also really sweet and adorable.
So adorable. Holy crap.
Yeah. And they kiss, you know, and she gives them a kiss, the little, you know, the Maid Marian is sort of, like pretend flirting with the little boy.
Oh, yeah.
And she gives him a kiss, and then one of the other kids goes like, a kiss! And they giggle and laugh. And when you're a little kid,
oh, yeah,
it's like charged.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of like, oh, man.
I want to know how they got this. I mean, that's another thing, too. Something in the room happened. Like, you can be as good an actor as you want. Those are natural laughs comes from those little kids. And yeah. I don't know what that is. I don't know.
I assume they had somebody who was good with kids. A voice director who was like, we're going to get these kids loose.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that's it. I've done very little working with children. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of characters who are children.
Sure.
And I always get adults to play them because they're very directable.
Uh-huh.
And extremely funny. Kids are... well used in Disney. They've done a good job in mm-hmm. a lot of their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so they must have had resident experts. They've, you know, over since Pinocchio on up, they must have just been like, we got this, we can do it.
Uh-huh.
Very few people, I mean, a lot of people don't quite know how. And then I feel like Peanuts almost made a weird, like, industry out of flat performances from kids that became normalized.
Uh-huh.
And you're kind of like, that's what kids sound like. I get it. That's what Charlie Brown sounds like. But it's actually, like, you know, kind of a weird stiff, you know, not bad, but sort of stiff performance.
Yeah, something you can kind of insert your own emotions over or whatever. I don't know what it is.
Or just sort of somehow emphasis doesn't matter anymore.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just emphasize any word.
What were you imagining when there's bits and pieces like, well, he was dressed like this. Like, did you have any picture? I mean, there's stuff going along with it in here, I suppose. But you weren't commonly reading along, right? Or it was just a lot of listening.
Before I could read, for the most part, though I think it crossed over.
Okay.
There's a lot missing. If you look at the picture book, you're seeing something like every fourth scene.
Yep, there we go.
And so I was not sure what to picture for some of this stuff. And there's like real weird stuff. Like there's a scene where the little kid, who is a tortoise, pulls his head, I found out later, into his shell.
Oh, yeah.
And then they reverbed his voice so that you are... to understand that his head is coming from inside.
Uh-huh.
You have no idea that is happening when you're listening to this record. And so you're just like left to imagine, like at that point, I guess the child becomes a memory and he's drifting off into, I don't know why he's suddenly reverbing. He's a ghost. There's Little John here, sort of dressed as a woman, but I don't think I understood that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, there's Robin Hood with his like, I guess gypsy fortune teller outfit on. But I think a lot of that was lost on me, and I didn't really understand it except just the basics of it. I knew Robin Hood and Little John were tricking them,
mm-hmm.
and I understood the basics of fortune telling. But there's a lot going on, and all that stuff. Again, you don't know what's happening. You just have this sense of something physical is going on, and I have to picture it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's part of the fun. You're sort of a little bit of maybe disassociation. You know, maybe there's like moments. Maybe a good radio drama, you know, should get away from the audience for a moment.
Sure.
And not imagine that every sound effect is explained as it happens. Maybe there's sometimes some benefit that happened accidentally with Disney records where they basically put their soundtrack, you know, I mean, I think they do a little editing, they do a little voiceover. But they, for the scenes that they present, I think they just kind of stuck them in.
Seems like it, yeah.
And so maybe there's like some magic in there too that, you know, we'll be able to tease out in the future when neuroscientists study our brains listening to Disney records.
Mm-hmm.
They'll see that like different parts of our cerebral cortex light up during the scenes when you don't know what the F is going on.
Uh-huh.
Who knows? Or not. Unfortunately.
But I do also love like that your child brain is drawing your own conclusions. That's where creativity starts to come from. Like, that's perfect. Like, to have little mysteries like that that are still consistent with what else is going on. So you're not like, your brain doesn't hurt.
Right.
Be like, what the fuck? And that's kind of great.
Right.
And I love that. So you had just the four records. Did your parents bring in any other records along the line? Did you get your own?
At some point, I remember we had a Casper, the Friendly Ghost record. I think we had a Wonder Woman record, which I think was like not from TV. I think it was like produced radio, like audio. My sister will remember that one better than me. That was pretty much it. I mean, the Jungle Book. I brought my little stack. These are records I bought for my kids off eBay to try to like recreate my childhood. And so far, by the way, it's not working. But I did have another record that is really fits in really well with this, and I brought it so we could just as a sidebar talk about the Muppet Musicians of Bremen.
Oh, yes.
Because this was really similar.
Mm-hmm.
And had a lot of similarity in terms of music.
For sure,
And also in terms of like what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You just get this, and it's very spooky.
Mm-hmm.
I think even the TV special that this is from, I think was probably spooky, but again, never saw it at all.
Oh my God.
Never had the opportunity until I was an adult, and even then I've only seen parts of it. So it's a little spooky as a TV special, but it's really weird as an audio event,
mm-hmm.
as a bedtime record, but also lovely,
mm-hmm.
And similar. And then, for me, The Jungle Book is also enormously powerful and was very similar in terms of like the just the way they did the book.
Yeah, yeah.
The experience of listening to these things, Jungle Book and Robin Hood in particular, is very similar for me, where you're just in, and of course has Phil Harris, has
yep.
basically the same guy,
uh-huh.
kind of holding down the bottom end of,
mm-hmm.
Of this thing, and also mixed that British and not British, British and country, if you will, or mm-hmm. whatever you want to call that, Southern actors combined with British actors, and nobody makes, yet somehow they all live in the same jungle, uh-huh. and or forest, which is great. It worked.
Yeah. And also, what's also interesting to me is that you then got to experience these characters without saying, wait, that Ka looks a whole hell of a lot like Hiss, and this guy looks a whole hell of a lot like that. You just get to hear only the voice characterization. So that's a kind of a benefit, I think.
I do, too. It was never confusing to me. I never mm-hmm. was like, what? I don't get it. Like, Baloo's a bear, and Little John's a bear, but they're not the same bear. Like, I think you just go with it. You're pretty relaxed about that stuff. More when you're a kid, I think you're more flexible than grown-ups think kids are.
For
it's
sure.
We project a sort of lack of flexibility onto kids in terms of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about that a lot here, where it's just like, we really like, Ken Marino. We just had him playing one character. Can we have him back as this other character? Can we have him back in the next episode? Or is there some waiting period? Like, do we have to, like, wait 3 episodes?
Not
like when the fans watch those episodes on Netflix, they might watch them back to back. So I don't even know why we have this sort of sense that, like, we can only use certain voices a few times, but then we've like burned them out. But I think ultimately, and The Simpsons does a good job of this, you just get the best people for the part.
Mm-hmm.
And don't worry about the fact, Phil Harris is not doing a voice.
No.
He's clearly just got the one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so good, they were like, yep, bring him back.
Mm-hmm.
Doing it again. Run it back. Same movie. I mean, when was Jungle Book?
That's a good question.
Let's see if it's on the record.
It should be. It should be on the front. If it's the same as the Robin Hood record, it's on the front of the Robin Hood record, at least.
On the very front?
Oh, yeah.
67.
There you go. Oh, wow.
67 okay. And Robin Hood 73.
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't know there was that
I
much
would
of a
have
gap.
Imagined they were closer, but I guess, and we'll let the Disneyologists weigh in on this, but mm-hmm. I guess Jungle Book was probably the end of an era, right? And
uh-huh.
Robin Hood
uh-huh.
was probably in the dark days that followed.
But some of my favorite stuff was in those periods, like, because all the, just for me watching all the hand-drawn stuff, and again, it was like nice and rough looking, and I still, again, love how kind of, I'd never paid attention again to how natural this sounds until just literally the idea of having you on the show, like, made me think about it in that different way.
I hadn't thought of it in those terms either.
Yeah.
I knew I loved it, but I
sure.
hadn't thought about the fact that it was this, like, relaxed experience. It's like Disney on sedatives.
It seriously is. Yeah. Like Robin Hood's kind of a hippie, but also kind of like, not a bumpkin, but he's just like this, I don't know. There's probably, I know there's a Shakespearean character I'm missing that he's probably also mm-hmm. very similar to, but I'm dumb. What about in terms of the music, I know what you like about the music. What's your history as a musician? Like,
I've loved music my whole life, and I've been really kind of intimately involved in, I guess what I would call is my own lazy musical journey.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like fills up an enormous amount of my brain, but I have also a shockingly little ability given how much I think about it
yeah.
and how much I care about it. So you know, I learned piano when I was a kid, and but I never practiced. And my teacher was nice. He basically saw that I wasn't doing the sight reading, and he was like, I don't know why I keep giving this to you every week. You know, you're not really learning it. Should we just stop?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, yeah, that's great. So he started just teaching me the things that I seemed to practice, which was very nice of him. Very, you know, late 70s, early 80s, kind of like groovy man. And as a result, I have no discipline, mm-hmm. but a deep love of music. And then in the early 2000s, I was lucky enough to run into a ukulele for the first time at a flea market. I had never really picked one up.
Mm-hmm.
And this was at a time before they became sort of as a little, they're a little sort of in the culture right now.
For sure.
And this was a period when they were not, though they were just about to be. So I didn't have, it wasn't like there was one at everyone's house like there is now. So I picked it up, and it was one of those things where it was a little bit of a bolt of light. I was like, this I can play.
Really?
I'd been frustrated by the guitar my whole life. It just always felt sort of awkward, and I always was annoyed because it's such a great instrument and I wanted to play guitar, but every time I picked one up, it just resisted me and made me feel stupid and clumsy. and the ukulele did not. And it's one of those things, once you have that feeling, you kind of have to respond. You basically have to say, well, I guess this instrument chose me, and now I write for this instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I hopefully try and practice this instrument.
Uh-huh.
And it really hit at a good time in terms of my career as a show creator and showrunner and writer, because I hired myself to do a lot of the music on the show I was working on at the time, which was an Adult Swim show called Lucy, Daughter of the Devil, and the ukulele became really important for that. And then when Bob's came along, it was the same thing, but more. Mm-hmm. I really leaned into it, and I just, while we were developing, just the earliest phases of development, I should say, we did the theme song. I did the theme song, mm-hmm. and I had help, and I'm glad to work with composers, especially you know, because I do need so much support. Mm-hmm. As a musician, I need people to suggest, like, well, why don't you try this in the bass? And what if I play the drums instead of you because you're not good at drums? but the passion that I now am able to bring to it, even though it's a little, you know, limited in terms of my abilities, I just go with it. I have unquestioned, I don't question my own, I question my own abilities, but I never question my own excitement.
Uh-huh.
About, let's record that. Let's get the ukulele. Let's get in here. Let's sing. So I am, you know, also sort of trying to, not to like artificially bring this back to Robin Hood, but I am in a way kind of recreating our little dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-do-da kind of music on Bob's, the udalali aspect. That's the minimalism and sort of simplicity of that music is really appealing, and especially because I found the ukulele, mm-hmm. I've kind of found my way back to that kind of thing. And it, again, it's not self-consciously ukulele music, just mm-hmm. like Robin Hood isn't self-consciously country, but it's just, you know, you tend to use simple chords.
It is unassuming too, I think.
Yes,
the ukulele, and like, I honestly, like, I love Bob's from the second I first watched it, but also, like, that show in terms of what it is now, I mean, all shows develop, but there's some things about it that do sneak up on you and are equally unassuming. Like, frankly, using H. John Benjamin at all, like, is like an unassuming thing, because I'm not going to say monotone because that's not fair to what he does, but it's a thing, and it's just there, and it sneaks up on you. And when he's sincere, fuck, it's one of my favorite things on TV.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Well, I tell anyone who will listen that I've never done a show without John. I don't care to know what it's like,
mm-hmm.
and I owe my whole career to him. He's the horse that I hitched my little cart to. His mm-hmm. voice is and I'm not the only show that benefits from having him as the heavy hitter.
Mm-hmm. I was asked to defend Bob's Burgers the other day on a podcast against Archer, and I'm like, well, there's no reason to defend it against it, but I've got plenty of arguments. But at the end, we're all like, yeah, but he's on both shows. So we're like, well, what are we going to do here?
Yeah, what are you
gonna do? Where does the argument go?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I have a million questions, and I do not want to keep you a million times, but can we talk about home movies for a second, too? I couldn't find any information about where what the impetus for that show is. I know a little bit more about where Bob's comes from, but I don't know about home movies. I don't know where you decided to do that. Why
home movies came about because we were getting a little bit of attention from Dr. Katz. It was this wonderful time when other cable channels were like looking at animation. You know, Comedy Central was a young network when we started with them, and when South Park hit, you know, they took off running, and obviously, in a way, didn't need Dr. Katz anymore. But we had a great period there where people came to us and said, please, can we have another can we have a show? How many shows you guys got in you?
Yeah.
And my boss, Tom, took an opportunity at FX. But UPN was also asking for a half-hour animated show. At the time, they said, we're going to go more towards family. We want you to make a show that's for families, that's about a family.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Snyder said to me, why don't you take this one? Go ahead and, you know, this will be your baby.
Wow.
And he mentored me and helped me, but it was my first kind of show to create. And I, in turn, took another piece of advice from him, which was find someone local to base it around.
Mm-hmm.
So I had two actors I knew I wanted to work with, or three, I should say, but I'll get to that in a second. One was this kid, Brendan Small, who was then a kid, a young man, who we found in a comedy club in Boston. The other person was Paula Poundstone, who was out here, but who we'd been using on this show called Science Court that we were doing for Saturday morning TV. And I had been working with her and enjoyed very much hearing about her. She had adopted all these kids and was just in the thick of it and was delightful to, you know, I just loved hearing her talk about that. So we heavily based the sort of Paula character on Paula Poundstone and her kids, but we also sort of merged that with this idea of this 8-year-old who was this precocious auteur filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we started, we were worried John Benjamin wasn't going to be available. He had moved to New York, and we just thought we might not always have him, but we couldn't resist asking him to please come back to Boston and record this pilot with us, and we cast him as the soccer coach.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was the missing piece, you know, and Melissa, and he also played Jason. So it all came together.
Yeah.
The cast was perfect. And, of course, later we lost Paula Poundstone, but Janine DiTullio replaced her really ably, and we lost UPN.
Right.
Or I should say, they canceled us. And I like to say they extra canceled us. They like canceled us hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was after 5 episodes, and the guy called and he said, I would lose my job if I even let you believe that we might give you another chance.
Oh my God.
I was like, got it. I think we were the second lowest rated show on their air, and they were the lowest rated broadcast network ever.
Jesus.
Or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So we really, really, you know, did not do what they wanted us to do. But thankfully, of the very few people who were watching, one of those people was a woman named Khaki Jones, who was working at Cartoon Network with her boss, Linda Simensky, and their boss, Mike Lazo. And they had just decided to start this thing called Adult Swim.
Yeah.
And it was going to be, they were going to license stuff to start. They knew they wanted to do originals. And with us, they basically asked if they could do both.
Yeah.
They said, can we license those 5 episodes, and can we pay for new production?
Awesome.
So within 6 months of getting canceled, we were back. We had this home that would, you know, was a great place for us for 4 years, and we were just lucky. As you know, luck is huge for almost anyone in this business. I think I feel like in my case, the luck is bigger than I have any right to deserve, but it's still great to meet people who loved that show and who connected with it, and I meet them all the time, and it's really nice. It was a really great experience doing it, and they were a great home for us. I worked with Adult Swim for a long, long time, and it was really nice that all worked out the way it did.
That show, just a quick sidebar for me, I'll just give you my part of it. It speaks to the ability of art to give you perspective on your own life and your own creativity, because episode one, they're making a little film called Dark Side of the Law, and my buddy and I, the first thing we ever created together was a little comic book called Dark Side of the Law.
Oh, wow.
And so we see that together, we're like teenagers at the time, like, oh shit, that's amazing. And we, like, for us it was just like, oh, we were dumb kids, and it was kind of a nice thing to see that reflected. It was like, should we feel stupid? No, because this show like super celebrated what it's like to be a creative little kid. I mean, so does Bob's Burgers.
Yes. No, it's the same.
I love that so
yes,
much.
Yes, it's the same. I'm interested in the same material. It seems yet again, and probably will be in the future, that urge when you're a kid that is both innocent and pure and, you know, just like a kid. All kids play pretend,
mm-hmm.
but at some point it seems that we split,
mm-hmm.
and there is a group of kids who just leave it behind,
yeah.
and they go outside and they play football or whatever, and then the rest of us stay inside. And in some form or another, go back to the toys, go back to mm-hmm. the whatever, go to the, you know, make a movie or play with Legos or write a song or whatever it is. But it's like we're not done playing, but we are getting older,
mm-hmm.
and we call it creativity. But I feel like that word doesn't do it justice. I haven't got a better one, but it's like in a way that glorifies it. It's this yeah. other thing. It's like we're still working on something. And a lot of us, I think, do like to see ourselves on the screen.
Of course.
And it just makes you feel a little better.
Uh-huh. You're
just like, everything's all right.
Uh-huh.
Everything I did was for a reason.
Uh-huh.
Totally fine. Not embarrassed. A little embarrassed, but I'm not going to be too embarrassed.
I mean, there's something in every single main character on Bob's Burgers. I'm like, oh shit, that's part of me. But again, it has the same power. I'm not that embarrassed. Maybe not Teddy, but Teddy's also my favorite character.
He's a big heart.
I don't know why. I don't know why. He's adorable. He's my favorite thing on that show. But yeah, and there is that. Again, I don't know that any of that's by design. You could tell me, obviously. But I, when you came up with what were the inspirations? Not necessarily in real life, but what's the reason for giving these characters these individual little? I mean, other than to distinguish them from each other and be interesting, is there something specific that you wanted to learn about humanity when you make Gene what he is, when you make Linda what she is? I mean, they're all kind of performers in their own little ways. I don't know. Is there something specific about why you gave them those traits?
I can answer that in two parts. I will say, in terms of how it happened, it's very much chemistry. It's, mm-hmm. you know, where you like... Or I should elaborate on that. It's wild, irresponsible chemistry,
mm-hmm.
where you have interesting ingredients and you combine them.
Yeah.
So in the case of Bob's, it was casting first,
mm-hmm.
knowing the people we wanted to work with, and then basically crafting the role for them.
Mm-hmm.
It was not hard. You know, it was instantaneous in a way. You know Bob is going to be John Benjamin. He's going to be the dad. You know John Roberts is going to be the mom.
Mm-hmm.
You know Kristen Schaal, just by her voice and by her energy, she's probably going to be the youngest. And with Eugene Merman, we knew, you know, I knew so much about him before we set pen to paper, partly because of Eugene Merman, but also partly because of me,
mm-hmm.
and my childhood, and I've been exploring characters like that on home movies. Dan Mintz playing Tina was the only one that we had to kind of do extra work on, because we cast Dan Mintz as a boy,
oh, right,
unimaginatively,
yeah.
boringly, and as there was, and we knew he was going to be a little horny, more of a, you know, a 13-year-old boy,
mm-hmm.
who's just beginning this awkward phase of life, and leaving, and there was going to be the separation between him and his siblings, because you're either in it or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
But the network didn't think that character was popping,
mm-hmm.
which is actually a pretty useful word. It's a little, it sounds like network speak, but I kind of like it, because it conveys a lot. A lot of these industry terms, they have like grossness attached to
uh-huh.
them,
uh-huh.
but they actually like are really useful. Popping is certainly one of them. We got what they meant. It was something about the design. It was something about this fact that we all kind of know that 13-year-old boys are like into sex, and it's sort of gross in a way, or mm-hmm. it's just boring. But we didn't. We. I'm glad that we had this trick up our sleeves of switching the sex of the character.
Yeah,
that was something we'd done a little bit on other shows, and I knew that it can create a second chemistry sort of explosion that
mm-hmm.
can work. So we tried it. We were very excited, instantly thrilled that they'd given us the note, and very interested in how they were going to react to our proposal of the solution.
Makes sense.
They were like, very surprised. They did not think that's how that was going to go at all.
Uh-huh.
And to their credit, we're all in.
Yeah.
They were just like, great, Tina, we love her. And so we were off and running.
So good.
And that, so that's the first part of your question of how did it happen?
Mm-hmm.
Second part of your question is kind of like, what are we doing with it? And what do I, or what do I think it all kind of means
to be
to
fair,
me?
It was a shitty question, but
no, it's a great question. I just have to separate it because we lucked into it yet again, or kind of, you know, I should say sort of fumbled our way into the creation of the characters without using big archetypes and kind of without knowing how well they would fit together.
Mm-hmm.
Without being able to articulate how well they would fit together, I should say. I knew how well they would fit together, but I don't know that I could have described it to you at the beginning. Now I look at it and I do see the extent to which they are all intensely creative.
Yeah.
And the extent to which it's still the same character in a way.
Mm-hmm.
These people who are compulsively creative, telling stories about them and celebrating them. And then in Bob's, we're slicing it pretty finely. There's different kinds. You know, this sort of the trickster mischief maker is a very specific kind of creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Gene's kind of the easiest to understand because we gave him a keyboard, so you get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tina, you know, you don't totally necessarily know how creative she is until you get to her erotic friend fiction, and then there's no question that she's off the charts, and her fantasy life is so rich that, you know, it could fill episode after, you know, we can go for 20 years if they let us.
Of course.
And then you have Bob, who's obvious, again, sort of obviously creative. He's disguised as this kind of like blue collar lug who's like just trying to like keep his restaurant afloat, but it takes only a very quick, you know, casual viewing of the show to realize that he's an artist who works in hamburgers, and that he is compelled to do this restaurant, and to change the burger of the day every day.
Of course.
And then Linda, again, you might, you know, maybe we didn't know when we started, but by the time we were into very, very quickly into the first season, you could feel that her creativity is coming out in song so often that she can't even hold it inside.
Yeah.
She's just constantly breaking into song, and so you get her urge and that particular flavor. So to loop it back to home movies and to our own childhoods, perhaps it's like it's different flavors of these, you know, whatever you want to call it, weirdo, nerd, whatever, who the people who indulge that and why. And I, you know, have my own little story, and everyone, all of us do. And I don't think our fans are limited to, you know, it doesn't mean we're just speaking to people who stayed in their room and wrote fan fiction.
Yeah.
Though we love those people and we are speaking to those people. But we're not exclusively speaking to them. And I think the reason is that even people who did put away the games of childhood and the pretend and all that and maybe didn't indulge, they had it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all had it at one point. Everyone kind of starts with that. And maybe, you know, we all kind of, I think, root for those people, even when sometimes we call them weirdos.
I love it. I have a million more questions, and I could sit and probably talk with you about audio editing for an hour.
Oh, please.
But so just to so that I can get out of your hair here, what would be a good reason? And this is perfect because we always ask, why listen to this album instead of watch the movie? You have an answer for that. So what's a good reason to condense why listen to this album?
I think you've got a rare thing here that probably will never happen again, where they were casting experienced actors, but they weren't casting celebrities. They were using their like tried and true voiceover people that they'd, you know, worked with on Jungle Book, but then, you know, bringing in Peter Ustinov, who like everyone knows his name at my age, but it was just we didn't know why.
Yeah.
He's not a celebrity that was cast for his celebrity. He was cast for his voice. So there's this wonderful, you know, pre-celebrity era of Disney. And that's not to say that when they cast some known names, that some of them do a great job.
Sure.
Sometimes there's a reason for that. But it's got an, I think, a moment in history here on vinyl that you will never, probably never get again.
Yeah.
Where they just tried to make the thing what it you know, and kind of let it be its purest self, and nothing about this feels forced, even for a second. Nothing about it feels even necessarily that polished.
Yeah.
So you're kind of getting like this raw material without any of the gloss or the slickness that I think would kind of come later and come to define like even the good Disney movies. They're really polished.
Sure.
So this isn't that, and yet it's so beautiful, and the music elevates it to a level of, I think, you know, close to perfection.
Yeah, that's perfect. This is going to come out in a few weeks. So what do you want to promote? Where can people find you? I mean, it's pretty obvious where they can find Bob's Burgers on Fox, but.
Yeah, Bob's Burgers. If this is coming out in a few weeks, then folks should tune in to Bob's on Sunday nights on Fox, because we will be coming up on our Halloween episode and our Thanksgiving episode and our Christmas episode. We always work very hard on the holiday episode. We work hard on all of the episodes.
Sure.
This year, we have an hour-long musical Christmas episode.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And we're also in the record business now. Uh-huh. And so, I mean, we are now putting comedy on vinyl, and we've made our season 1 through season 6 record, where we put as many of those songs as we could into one box set. And we want to keep doing that. The goal with the first one was simply to make people happy, number one, and to see if we could do it again, number two. And the answer to the first is, of course, subjective, and I cannot tell you, but I like to think it makes people happy. But the answer to the second part is we are going to do it again. So what you're seeing now on Bob's will be season 8.
Mm-hmm.
We've just aired season 7 last year. We're going to take all the music from those two episodes and little bits of dialogue and covers, if we're so lucky as to get some more bands to do them, and we'll put it on a season 7 and 8 record.
Oh my God.
And release it next fall. And we want to just keep doing that. We want to honor the music of the show and the voices of the show and the audio experience, you know, recreate our own little slice of this, of listening to old Disney records. And we want to end the feeling, you know, the physical objectness of it, as everyone knows, the reason why vinyl's still here, why we're talking now is, because, we are humans and we still want to hold things and open them up like this and look inside and find out what color the vinyl is and whether there's something printed on the sleeve. And we're thrilled to be doing that. It's a labor of love for us. And Sub Pop is a fantastic record label and is doing it for the exact same reason.
Yeah. This has been ridiculously fun.
Oh, good.
Obviously, you're welcome to come back. No pressure.
Pleasure.
But it would be I'd love to have you back. That's really it. I don't have anything to promote. Who the hell am I? Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.